So the rest of the session, I wanted to sort of talk about workability, whether there's any, I don't want to talk about policy, but because that's, we've sort of been through two phases with the policy stuff. I want to talk about whether there's anything, a little bit like the timeline discussion we had before with the expert opinions, whether there's anything else like that in terms of the implementation that we need to be thinking about. Have you shown you?
I guess, the round session. I think some of the workability stuff is a little bit like some of the examples David brought up around, you know, any complaints or similar. So things like in the ADR, the number of safety related incidents in relation to Aurora's supply of electricity distribution services. So it's the kind of breadth of that. So, you know, is that designed to include like contractor injuries? Is it really about network, you know, safety incidents regarding network assets, because that was a principal concern in their submissions around safety items. So, you know, we could end up having a big long list, or a big long list of some trivia in there, or a more.
It's in C.
Yes, yeah, 1.4.2 the page.
Yeah, because it's not defined term, right? That's really what you're saying.
No, but it's about Aurora's supply of electricity distribution services, but that's our core business. It's what we do. So
it covers everything?
Yeah. But I'm not sure that was really the intent of it.
I'm just conscious I'll probably have to drop off in about half an hour, but there was a couple of other probably items under attachment C from me.
We've
1.2, which is the self-assessment. On this side of the virtual table, if you like, EDBs have had mixed results trying to do AMAT over the last few years. Grant, I'm sure you know. Sometimes self-assessments are onerous to complete. So I guess we were wondering where that's come from, why you think there's value in us assessing ourselves, and if there is value in assessing ourselves, in the absence of some sort of guidance beyond one low, five is high, I think it's going to be difficult for us to, to do that exercise, because without having some kind of yardstick, if you like. And also, it becomes pretty onerous if we are going down a particular path of assessment and we bring in external people who take a potentially different view. That's obviously got potential implications for the fact that we've publicly disclosed a different view, albeit it's a subjective view. So, I mean, I think for us, it's a case of what's the value that the Commission sees in this from the point of view of stakeholders. And if that value proposition is good and you're keen to stick with it, then what further guidance can there be provided?
So the guidance would be about,
I guess my long rambling question's got two limbs, Grant. It's like where's the value in us doing a self-assessment for consumers in all of these nine areas? Yeah. And then if that value is there, then I think potentially here or elsewhere we'll probably just need some guidance as to how we should be looking to do this,
like the 1 to 5.
Well, yeah, because even the AMAT's got some sort of, the AMAT's got a kind of an understanding now as to how you score yourself. You still see, again, I'm just using AMAT as an example, and you see different levels of awareness, let's just call it, across the industry. And therefore, if I look at something like 1.2.7, rating ourselves for identifying and mitigating safety risks, that's, to be fair, that's kind of an open-ended and some way onerous question to ask a business to assess itself on. What's 5? What's 1?
I guess the other thing that's missing is, well, having established a self-assessment rating on each of those things, what do you then do with it?
No, that's a good point. I mean, obviously, if it's a low one, you'd look to improve. But I mean, I think this also overlaps with the purpose of the mid-period review. Mm. And given we'd effectively only be publishing this once before then, in 2023, I guess overall, what value does it bring to the table? Okay. I don't necessarily think we're expecting an answer. It's just a case of that's probably what we'll submit on.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
And you know, just like the discussion we had around the low voltage network monitoring before, you've got the same issue. So, you know, what benchmark do you rate yourself against? Mm. Is it normal practice, best practice, emerging practice? The risk one that David identified, I guess, you know, there are objective standards for risk management against which we've developed our risk management policy. But it probably doesn't help.
Well, no, that's true, Alec. I mean, you can put in the ISO 9000 or whatever it is, and some of those things, but it doesn't tell us how well we've applied it.
That's right, and it doesn't give us any sense of, you know, scale between 1 and 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so look, I mean, I guess trying to summarize again, Grant, it's where do you guys see the value in this, and assuming that value proposition holds, how can we make this usable and specify in such a way that we can actually apply it usefully?
Yeah, got that.
On the assumption that we're not going to answer all those questions today, 1.3 has a couple of aspects that wanted to bring up. 1.3.1a has a trigger for us giving information or explaining variances, should I say, and it's the $1 million and the 10%. Again, you know, why were they chosen? Are they, because when you look at a polls program, it's obviously, it could be a reasonably large number. Having $1 million variance in a $20 million project is probably not that big an issue. But part of this issue is also that there's a reasonably wide possible interpretation of projects and programs. And, you know, we'll try and interpret that, but then our interpretation of that then has implications in this respect.
I think, I mean, the $1 million was just to try and strike out the de minimis type expenditure, and the 10% was, I suppose, reasonably arbitrary in the sense of then it signifies something that's material, potentially material.
Yeah.
If you've got another way of specifying that, then I'm quite happy to hear about that. But really what it was trying to do was to say, well, here's a category of expenditure which is more than just de minimis. And in that category of expenditure, it has moved by 10% or more from the original proposal.
Yeah, okay. And I guess that was my second point. It is against the original proposal that this should be looked at, well, as we go through the period.
Well, given the discussion we had earlier on with Jude,
yeah,
maybe it should be against the development plan rather than the original application.
I think over time, the comparisons against the original plan become less and less valuable. Probably just test our working assumption with you. I mean, for us going too granular in this 131A is probably going to be onerous, but we thought it would probably look, our granularity, if you like, would look something like the level of detail we provided in what we call the CPP tracker and those spreadsheets. So that would have about 30 or 40 spend lines, as opposed to what's implied by 1.3.1.B, not necessarily implied, but obviously you're switching things back into ID categories. I'm probably confusing you, but my question really relates to is the granularity that we should be looking, or we should be trying to achieve is for us, it's probably the level of what we proposed in the CPP process.
Can you give me a link or a pointer to what it is that I don't recollect it. So
because we certainly can. It will have been shared with you already. So we'll just provide you with a link to what I say we call the CPP tracker.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the rolled up view of all our spend models.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could definitely give you that. It'll be kids just pointing it out on SharePoint, I think, wherever we used placed it before.
Yeah.
And I guess with that then, just carrying on, I guess. So 131B and C, CapEx and OpEx, are in ID categories. I mean, we will have to do that translation for the AMP in any case. It's just we are wondering of the value of including it in the ADR.
So that this is by subnetwork.
It is also by subnetwork, correct, yes. So it just adds another layer of...
another complication.
So I think that's... So if you look at B and C, that's really what you would provide, or normally would provide under Schedule 7, depending on what the reference is for proposed capital or proposed operational expenditure, which is usually the AMP minus one.
For that, yeah.
But I think the main benefit here is that it's at a sub-network level to provide a little bit more transparency to pricing area customers.
So you're saying the breakdown in B and C should be the breakdown that was given for the C?
I'm not sure that I'm saying that.
Well, I guess my original point, Grant, was just trying to tease out the basis for using ID categories, which is, you know, one step removed from how we built our CPP. If it's a case of, you know, trying to provide useful information to those customers in the subnetworks, then I guess we'll take that away. But my original point was just trying to get a view as to why we were using ID as opposed to what we would have used in the CPP, and whether or not there was a conscious reason for that.
Oh, I think it's just consistency with the rest of the ID. I mean, this information is only going to be used. It's not going to be used as comparatives to other ID information. So, and it's going to be used to measure progress against the CPP. So if you think there should be different expenditure categories there, then we'd be open to hearing that.
Okay, because I guess it's, we effectively have to do it in A, and then we're just kind of presenting a different view of it in B and C.
Yeah. But
We'll put that a different way. To be able to comply with A, if that's the right term, we need to do all of this analysis on a CPP basis,
right,
to find the variances. But then we would be, and potentially in A, we'll be talking about projects A and B, which then don't show up in B and C.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something we've grappled with internally in terms of, to be fair, the business doesn't run itself in terms of B and C.
Right.
And as Alec has said, or Shan, I think, we will be reporting this information anyway. And I get the point about the subnetworks, but I guess it's what's going to be of most value. Is it some view of the CPP at a subnetwork value, level, or is it B and C? I take the consistency point, but I think it's probably just, from our perspective, just going to add to the layers of reporting.
Okay. No. I hear what you're saying. The question is, once you've done A, how do you break it down to show key elements under B and C?
Yeah, from a practical point of view, if we do A, that's going to be more granular than B and C.
Yeah.
And any deltas, if you like, that show up in A may not apply in B and C. But look, yeah. I guess, go back to my original point, I was just trying to tease out whether or not that was a conscious view that you wanted some kind of consistent timeline or trend to do with ID. But it sounds like there was an element of that there. And we'll just look to try and play this back in our submission as to what the implications are, again, on the basis of, we're talking about workability at the moment.
Yeah, I guess if the translation that you would need to do for B and C is onerous, what is it that you're suggesting as the substitute?
Right, okay, well, let's... Alec, I think we'd probably just take that away and just maybe think a little bit more about the mechanics of it, and again, from a workability perspective.
Yeah. I'm not saying that the categories that are listed there and currently listed there in B and C are a must-do. We don't have a... It's only consistent because it's an ID specification within an ID determination.
Yes, no, with you, yeah. Relating to a CPP proposal.
Yeah.
I think there's a related complication in these also that we're looking to restructure or have restructured our financial reporting to capture subnetwork costs as they've been defined, as the subnetworks have been defined by the Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So we should be able to do the actuals for A, B, and C reasonably easily.
Mm-hmm.
And jump in here, David, but
I think the total actuals. I think that's a really good point, Alec. And obviously, it's an evolving process in some ways. But A, from when we're doing this breakdown of the regions, it's going to be more based on what's going to be seen at A rather than B and C. And at a total, it's reasonably easy to transfer from A to B and C. But I don't think we've necessarily done the math, so to speak, or looked at how onerous it might be at a subnetwork level.
Right. Well, my understanding is that, you know, because we will be reporting the disclosure categories at least at a network level, it's just a simple matter of dividing them by where the costs actually lay in terms of where we spent the money. But the point I was going to make is when we developed our CPP proposal, a lot of our modelling, you know, survivor curves, our asset health models or risk models or you know, fleet models and that were on a network basis, and they weren't modelled at the subnetwork basis.
Mm-hmm.
So we've either got to turn around in order to be able to develop planned versus actual, we've either got to rebuild models to do it at a subnetwork level, or we've got to allocate.
Yeah.
And if we allocate, that will potentially drive variances inherently.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, David?
Yes. No, I think you're right. And again, like, in some way, the 1 million de minimis might help in that respect, but you will get, let's call it, unintentional variances or spurious variations probably showing up.
In terms of C, actual operational expenditure compared to proposed, I'd just make the point that SONS and business support are generally centrally incurred and not by subnetwork, so they should probably be excluded.
Now, just out of interest, how are they allocated then in terms of the pricing methodology?
So it's stipulated in our pricing methodology, but that those costs are generally allocated to pricing regions on an ICP basis.
That's a formulaic kind of approach.
Yeah, so our approach to subnetwork cost allocation in terms of pricing is that the costs, the network specific costs should fall where they lie or lie where they fall.
Yeah.
But consumers should expect to receive scale benefits from having those shared costs of the SONS, you know, the shared overhead costs. Generally, it's got to be in proportion to somewhat into something.
Yeah.
I wonder, Grant, where 1.3 refers to is doing on each of its subnetworks, whether or not qualifying that, like this is getting into drafting, unfortunately, whether or not, you know, that gets qualified by as appropriate or where relevant or as applicable or whatever the right terminology is. Because as Alec says, we trying to say where we spend SONS dollars is not overly meaningful in a regional sense. And even this the sub categories of business support as well, even more so. So, I mean, I think any kind of I don't think anyone's going to be helped by us saying that we spend all our governance and administration monies in Dunedin. That doesn't necessarily help. It's not adding value to anyone by pointing those kind of things out.
Yeah.
And if anything, it might lead to confusion that's probably not warranted.
Yep, okay.
Providing for, in 1.4, providing for each of Aurora's subnetworks in a time series form for the most recent five disclosure units. So it's the planned, unplanned, SAIDI and SAIFI. So that requires us to do a little bit of unpacking of the last 5 years. It's a little bit onerous. But the definitions, so they're intended to be network and subnetwork. So network's obviously easy, but just got to...
So where was that again?
Sorry, 1.4 on page 103. And this touches on... a little bit what I talked about this morning. So so for the network and subnetwork, provide the following. So a time series of the most recent five disclosure years, planned and unplanned, SAIDI and SAIFI. So the points I would make there, Grant, is that the unplanned SAIDI values and unplanned SAIFI values and planned SAIDI and SAIFI values are all linked back to, mean SAIDI based on class C, unplanned interruptions on the network for unplanned SAIDI. So it's not clear to me that these are normalised or non-normalised. And it comes back to that issue of, even at the network level, if we're required to use normalised values, and I would suggest that they should be raw values, we would have to try and recalculate limits based on DPP3 for the preceding 5 years, which would be tough. We wouldn't have any basis for doing that at a subnetwork level.
Okay, I get that.
My view is that the easiest way to comply with that is just using raw or non-normalised figures. And from a consumer perspective, that probably represents closer to what is actually experienced. Because consumers don't go, oh, look, there was a storm or a major event day,
It also more closely aligns with how we've been reporting in Schedule 10. And so then if somebody wanted to dive more into those values and see the disaggregated SAIDI and SAIFI, then Schedule 10 is readily available to them and they've got something they can directly correlate
values. Our perspective of providing the last 5 years' history, it's just a matter of going to those schedules and picking the numbers out.
But that's only at the entity level, right? It's not subnetwork. So,
No. It's harder for us because we've been doing our disclosures in Dunedin and Central Otago. Yeah. So we're still going to have to disaggregate the Central Otago region.
But it's doable. It's doable.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Well, we think it's doable.
Alec, I'm probably just going to have to jump off in a couple of minutes. So there was one other point I just wanted to make before I did so. And again, it's probably something we'll obviously follow up in the submissions. But Grant, under 132D, which probably should be A, I think, the number of assets compared to the number of assets Aurora planned. I mean, when we say Aurora planned, is that the CPP proposal we're reporting against, or again, the new plan or the delivery plan? I think there's probably a couple of places under 1.3 where that isn't fully clear, if that makes sense, the difference between our reporting baseline.
So, sorry, I fell a bit behind there. 132B.
No, sorry, it's 132A, but it's, I think it's a typo and it says D at the moment.
That's just a different font. It's actually an A.
Microsoft are getting rid of Calibri. That might be the problem. It's Aurora planned to replace. Sorry, it's what version of the plan we're reporting against.
Yeah, okay. Well, so I think that's a general thing.
Correct. No, it applies in a few places. Yeah.
That we need to sort out, which is, what do we mean by plan?
Yes.
You know, and that gives you the baseline then. I guess my sort of preliminary view on that is that when we're talking about a plan, it's the development plan, which is the reconciled plan, not the original proposal.
Yeah, so the project and program delivery plan.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But.
No, that's fine, because there are actually, when you look at it, there's references to plan, and then there's also references to proposal, which would probably delineate between the two. But as you can probably understand, just having clarity around exactly which ones we need to report against will obviously allow us then to do a better job of figuring out how workable it is, and obviously being able to submit in that respect.
Yeah, we'll need to do some thinking on that, so we may not be able to get back to you.
No, that's fair. But I understand that. But
if you've got a particular view of what the plan should be for purposes of the baseline, then I think you should tell us that in your submission.
Right. Not okay. That makes sense. Yeah. What's more appropriate?
What you think's more appropriate? Yeah. You know, what is the appropriate baseline for referencing for actual versus planned progress against plan and, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure, that's understood. I mean, I think as we kind of talked about earlier, I mean, as we move through the period, the proposal gets less and less accurate, if that's the right word, and then the variances just start to grow and you're not necessarily learning anything. But we are conscious, obviously, that you will want some reconciliation back to the higher level plan as to what we said we'd originally do. Now, we could take that away and we can make suggestions or...
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I'm wanting is, as modifications are made to the delivery plan, either because of your experience or comments from the expert opinions or whatever reason, us giving you feedback, consumers giving you feedback, and you modifying the plan as you go along, that there's transparency on the modification process and that's communicated back to consumers and other stakeholders as you go along. So there's effectively an audit trail that anyone could follow if they wanted to.
Right, understood. I mean, obviously, business would would have that sort of for its internal control processes. But I guess what you're saying is that there is some kind of a high level explanation for consumers to know why we're doing X instead of Y. And I think it's that would come out in a ADR that's being presented well or and given the information that they require. So no, that's understood. Yep.
Yeah. But I'll take it on board that we will go through and look at references to plan and planned and
proposed.
And versus proposed. Yeah. And make it clearer what the reference there to plan means.
No, that'd be great. That'd be useful. Sorry, unfortunately, guys, I'm going to have to jump off. Just like to thank everyone. That was a really good discussion, and I'm sure we'll continue it via Word documents in the future.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thanks, David.
Cheers, Alec. I'll catch up with you guys afterwards to where we ended up.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you. Right.
So I think 1.4.3 again on page 104. I think we're back to safety values, but I think that's okay because these are actually the plan, and I think this is maybe the difference. So when we were talking about reliability earlier on 1.4, it was planned SAIDI values rather than planned SAIDI assessed values, which I think are the normalised values. So I think that's okay. So that would probably resolve 1.4.1. 1.4.3, that's restricted to Aurora's network.
Yes, network as a whole. Yeah.
But when you get over to 1.5.3b, and we're talking worst served consumers, their plans, SAIDI assessed values. So again, they're normalised at the feeder level, which is not impossible, but it's difficult to do. And I'm not sure that would be consistent with the practice we apply for working out worst served consumers, because we tend to look at the total impact.
So how would you change B?
I would remove the word assessed.
Oh, okay. And does that take it back to raw values?
Takes it back to raw values.
Okay.
Because the other difficulty with assessed values is that it depends on what you mean, and it's how you set up your reliability reporting for sub-transmission faults. So if you consider the Alexandra to Omakau line, 33 line, that's then got a zone substation with four feeders. If you suffer an outage that turns into a major event on the 33 kV line, all of those feeders are affected.
Mm-hmm.
And then splitting the normalised effect to each of those feeders is problematic. And what else was I going to say about feeder? Oh, yes, the other thing is what, and it may be the way we clarify it. So it's the feeder line supplying the worst served consumers. But what's fairly common, if this is our zone substation here and this is a long rural line, it's common to have recloses in here. And so we would So this might be a circuit breaker one. We recall this 1R or something like that, or 1R2. So these are designed. These are designed that if a fault occurs there, it doesn't impact all of these consumers as well. So you would naturally expect in a rural feeder that this might have 6, 4, 2 something outages in a year. So, you know, are we looking at this feeder, or are we looking at this feeder segment, or is it up to us to define how that is? Because this will feature in worst served, but it's deliberate, right? You know, so you can work to try and reduce the impact there. You know, this, however, might have much fewer consumers. You know, it's end of line stuff, so you know, it probably doesn't feature as a contribution to overall network reliability. But it's just kind of unclear how we go about it from a workability perspective.
I think it's probably where it says for the feeder lines, I think, based on that explanation. I think it would be feeder line or segment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, because
we're not really interested in those if those are kind of no exceptions. You know, they're not. It's this.
Yeah.
That we're interested in.
Yeah.
It's where you cut it off.
Yeah, and like we might have to develop a methodology to explain.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Also, with the just the difference between using for and normalised, just with the new normalisation methodology for unplanned savings, say in the DPP and CPP, moving to the half hour periods makes it more challenging, because all of the interruptions that occur on the network for within that half hour period are allocated to that half hour period. So you're not actually normalising individual interruptions as such, you're normalising a half hour period. So then breaking it back to feeders is just not consistent with how the methodology is currently applied. So
yeah, that's why I'd recommend removing the
SCS and just going to raw.
Well, again, it's a little bit of a drafting thing, right? But in 1.53A above, using the map, Aurora publicly discloses under 2.3.13. That's the heat map for related parties.
I don't know where that came from.
I would just be inclined to, you know, using a map of Aurora's network service area or something like that.
Yeah. That looks like whoever was doing this just made a grant for something.
Yeah.
A map that we're already
using. Yeah, I know. They probably did a word search for map. Yeah.
I don't think
if there's a more sensible...
Probably just saying map, and then it would be left up to us as to whether or not we determine to reuse that same map. But if we feel that there's a more appropriate map that would better reflect those, then we could have that flexibility.
So I think that kind of covers the bits of the ADR, I think, that probably causes some challenge, or you know, relatively unclear.
Yeah, I just need to get a note of that map thing.
It's at 1.5.3A.
Yeah.
Yep.
I guess the map needs to be in sufficient detail that that somebody who's on a feeder or a segment of a feeder can see themselves on the map?
Yeah, I would suggest it would be, you know, we tend to look at our Central Otago and Dunedin maps separately for the ID purposes, but it would probably be, we might need a series of maps like at GXP level or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my gut feeling is because rural networks don't tend to be interconnected and therefore you frequently are unable to restore by switching, you actually have to fix the fault, that we will probably find that it's those rural areas that will be worst served. And that's pretty typical for any network, I would suggest.
And those heat maps that we're disclosing already for related parties, the projects and programs that we're identifying on those are at a very high level, where it's just a dot point on a map that we're going to be upgrading this zone substation or stricter line. It's very high level and I don't think would be appropriate to be used.
And it was quite a high level of materiality too, my recollection. You know, the
it's just the top 10. OPEX and CAPEX projects and programs.
Other than that, Glenn, I'm not sure that there's anything that particularly sticks out at me now. It's kind of interesting as we look at this and we're building our submission, some things pop up that you didn't see before anyway.
But I guess, you know, just as a matter of principle, 1.5.3a, the use of a map, as a general proposition, we are comfortable with you using something different from what we're proposing there, and we've got an open mind about specifying that that approach in the way we end up drafting it. But I guess we want you to tell us that you want to do that and why.
I think in principle, there's nothing wrong with what's proposed there. We've just got to work out.
But you're saying there's a more workable approach. Potentially is.
Yeah, look, I would suggest that using the same map is probably not as useful for consumers.
Well, that, at the end of the day, that's the outcome we're looking for.
The high voltage feeders are difficult to identify at, you know, too high a scale. So if we fed into, GXP level, I think we could adequately show the towns and, you know, have maybe the lines in blue and a red segment for the worst served areas as they're defined, that would allow consumers to pinpoint where they sit on the map. I think that's the key feature that we're trying to achieve with that map.
So if there are other instances like that where you think that there's a better answer, and again, I think the guiding principle is what gives better information for consumers and other stakeholders.
Yeah.
And you think there's a better answer, or one that's more workable from Aurora being able to provide good information, then let's get that embedded in there now, rather than having to do exemptions and other modifications as we go along.
Yeah, so I think that's an example of what we would provide in our red line or something like that. You know, rather than using the map that Aurora publicly discloses under clause blah, 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 it might be using a map at, you know, sufficient scale to let consumers understand where the, you know, words of that effect fit. That might be a better way of going about it.
And that demonstrate either feeders or segments of feeders that are affected by that measure. But there'll be other examples of that you come across as you go through here. So I'm quite happy to take submission points on that.
We're getting to the stage now where we've got to start writing it. You know, even if if we miss something, we'll just pick it up and cross subs anyway.
Well, I think that part of the reason why we've written into the requirements that there's to be an annual update with us in respect of the ADR is for us to provide feedback on how we think you've gone in terms of meeting the requirements, just qualitatively, not compliance-wise. And then secondly, are there any burning issues there that would require amendments, modifications? So we would do the same thing here with the, I'm not saying that there would be annual amendments, but that we would meet annually and we would talk about those things and give each other feedback, I think.
Yeah, and I think this is an area that, you know, sort of I had discussion with the team last week around compliance and that sort of thing. And my view, you know, rightly or wrong, and you may agree that, you know, compliance is we address the topic, and we might have a slightly different viewpoint to the commission or have interpreted it slightly different. That, in my mind, is not a compliance issue. That's a discussion about whether the ID has actually correctly specified it and whether it needs to be improved.
Yep.
Rather than, you know, a strict, no, you failed to comply with this provision, I think, you know, we'll be taking the view that if we're unsure of something, we'll probably ask. If we don't have time to ask, or for whatever other reason, we'll be sort of weighing up, would this be more useful to consumers than an alternative?
Yeah, I think probably the guiding principle is it useful to consumers? And given the discussion that's been had over the last while, is that usefulness at a regional level? You know, regionality is, you know, it rates high on the radar screen. So the usefulness thing has to be measured on a regional basis rather than as a general rule.
I think that probably
it won't be in all cases, in most cases
quantitative stuff more than anything. The more qualitative stuff, you know, developing asset management practices, risk management, doesn't really have a subnetwork.
No, it doesn't.
focus.
Thank you. Your comments about meeting regularly and assessing the reporting requirements and perhaps having that flexibility is really positive. It perhaps circles right back to the first thing we mentioned this morning about the way the ID determination has been drafted. Perhaps having Aurora's ID requirements sitting in a separate document outside of this would just make those amendments throughout the CPP period a little bit easier to make, as opposed to constantly going back and amending the ID determination that applies to all the EDVs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think you should make that point in the submission. That it allows greater flexibility in terms of updating.
Thanks, so, if it was just sitting.
I think. We're also mindful that, you know, we'd like to get the determination into a position where we can comply with it and not have to come seeking exemptions or modifications.
I guess stability has value, but there are some categories of information where we're ambitious, and we talked about it earlier on about the focus on safety versus reliability being the primary thing to start with. But over time, whether it's in the first CPP period or the second regulatory period, we're keen in particular for the asset management methodology to mature from a volumetric, which is a very raw kind of approach, to ultimately kind of where we're taking Transpower and PowerCo and others to more of a risk-based prioritisation of expenditure going forward, you know?
Yeah, and I think there is a certain element of improvement around risk management, asset criticality, etc. But I think there also needs to be a little bit of caution, because the distribution environment lends itself to a little bit more on the kind of fleet modelling basis than does the lower number of discrete assets that are existing in the transmission space.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see, you know, maybe distribution will get there over time, that they are as detailed on the assets as Transpower, but I think we're a fair way off yet as an industry. I think as we develop our, you know, as you go through an asset life cycle, I think, and we implement our asset management system, we'll have much more granularity than we've ever had in the past. So that if you install a pole, it's got a discrete asset ID, you know everything about that pole, including when you do a cross-arm change, you've added an LV distribution fuse or something like that. It's all in its life cycle, which we don't have that information at the moment.
Well, you got different types and all sorts of things, you know.
We'll be doing some asset capture and obviously translating existing data. We know a lot about, we have a lot of information about our assets. But until it's systematized, we don't know a lot about our assets, if you know what I mean. So we kind of know what concretes we've got. There are different type of concretes. In terms of poles, we'll start to understand the life cycle of those different types of poles over time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, though, it takes time, because it's time itself that determines how those assets degrade and fail.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're a wee way off the, you know, Transpower's in a much better place than we are at the moment.
I think, yeah, I still think there's a story that needs to be told, though, to consumers and other stakeholders as you progress along. And that story is about, well, what is it that you're doing about that to systematize?
Yeah.
What are you doing about the data capture? What are you doing about cost allocation?
You can see that reflected in your ADR requirements and the picture that you're painting.
So that
is covered to a degree by those development plans and then the subsequent reporting.
The rating thing, I guess, is quite interesting. I'll have to go back and talk with Sartner about it, about the self-assessment thing. Is, you know, how do you rate your own progress, or should you rate your own progress?
I think you should.
Yeah.
Because that's about understanding where you are, whether you do it in quite that way. I think the difficulty is actually publishing that in the current climate because, one, from a consumer's perspective, you go, so what? It's just what they say. The thing is, and this is the difficulty that we've got, I think, as an industry, things like AMIT are probably quite useful for the commission. Consumers don't read it. Mm. They don't understand it. And it's difficult, you know, asset management anywhere is a difficult technical exercise. And, you know, and that goes for whether it's water, it's electricity or whatever. And most consumers don't know, don't want to understand it. You know, they just want to know that the lights are on. And they probably do want to know, you know, at a high level that a business is working at a good level or is moving to working at a good level. The deep aggregation and deep dive into technical matters probably don't carry much weight with consumers because it's difficult for them to, you know, that there is a, and this is the challenge I think we have with the pricing methodology, there is a degree of detail that once you go beyond, you've lost people.
Yeah.
That's tracking the balance.
Yeah, it is. And making the explanations that you provide, you know, more readable, more understandable. That's kind of where we've focused this year. I'm not saying we're perfect by a long stretch, but we've made quite a leap in our pricing methodology this year.
Yeah, I can see some things when you make those comments. I can see some things in the way we've drafted some of these that we couldn't help ourselves in the sense that, you know, we are the commission and we like detail, and so we dived into the detail. And whereas the principle of what we're trying to achieve is actually good, understandable, qualitative information for consumers, you know, to tell them how you're progressing and to give them just enough to enable them to have confidence that you are progressing. There's a balance that I think we've probably just slightly stepped over. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that, in my view, information disclosure should start with, you know, what do we want to understand? And therefore, what information do we need to collect to do that? Rather than, here's the things we'd like to, like you to provide,
and we'll figure it out.
How do we work out what we want to, you know? The difficulty from a consumer perspective, I think, is there will be some people that do want to know about the detail. There will be some people that want to know at a high level, and there's probably 90% just want to know when the power goes back on if it goes out. You know, that's all they, you know, that is the feedback we get at the moment is if the power goes out, what information can you give us to let us know A, what's happened and B, how long it's going to be. Mm, yeah. That's what we really want to know.
And there are also other avenues for consumers to access information. It's outside what we publicly disclose as well. It's just limited to what we put on our website. If they want to make, you know, people want to ask questions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, make a query or ask a question to get them more data and information.
But, you know, we are reasonably, you know, we are focusing quite a degree on trying to be more transparent about mm-hmm. what we're doing.
And it comes across in the discussions we've been making.
Yeah.
So I guess I've got one last question. Have we missed anything? Is there anything that should be in there that's not in there? Or should we just leave that to your BAU processes to cover that you would make the judgment call on providing that in your updates to?
I think. Yeah, you might want to put a catch-all in the ADR requirements, you know, any other information that the EDB considers might be useful to consumers.
Yeah.
But I haven't actively considered those areas because, you know, again, we do come from a bit of a compliance focus, you know, what is the commission asking for and can we provide it and can we provide it in the time and the detail that's being requested, you know, and so our starting point has been to start with the determination and work backwards. Yeah. We haven't really started with the reasons paper and assessed the determination of has the commission put everything in here that it talked about in the reasons paper. Yeah, I think that the one area where we might continue to do some thinking is, you know, we might find the odd scenario where we think the commission's been too prescriptive and we can actually present this information in a better way.
Yep. Happy to hear that.
And even beyond the determination, I think we would raise those issues with the commission and you know, discuss our rationale and see if we could reach some sort of agreement around that.
Yeah. That's good.